My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Jonah Lerner. Jonah, welcome to KBOO and welcome to Portland.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been to Portland before?
I've never been to Portland before.
This
is my first
time.
This is my kind of town.
Excellent.
But I think you guys need a few more coffee shops. I've noticed you don't have enough swanky coffee shops.
Or places to buy beer.
Well, what else do you need? I mean, life's essentials.
That's right. We have long winters here, and a cup of coffee and a glass of beer helps us get through.
Yeah. Amen.
The title of your book is How We Decide. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I guess the first question has to be, how did you decide to do the book?
It was really through my own failings. I'm one of those pathologically indecisive people. I'll spend 20 minutes in the cereal aisle choosing between different kinds of Cheerios, you know, honey nut, apple cinnamon, that weird multigrain yogurt one. I'll spend half an hour trying to pick a toothpaste. So it was that very basic everyday failing that I think we can all relate to a little bit that first got me thinking about what was happening inside my head when I was struggling to choose a breakfast cereal and what should be happening inside my head. How should we make these everyday decisions? So it was really my own failings that got me interested in the subject. And I was just lucky enough to stumble onto a rather new science that I think is revealing lots of interesting stuff that actually shows what's happening inside our brain when we make decisions.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you about, and maybe we should start with that. One of the things that the book does is to take us through the architecture of our own brain, talk about various brain structures and their functions, mm-hmm. and how that helps us make decisions, and also the chemicals that wash our brain as we make these decisions and help us or not help us, as the case may be. So being an old hippie, I have to ask you, are we simply a collection of our own structures and chemicals? Are we puppets on some kind of a determinist string? I mean, what's going on here?
I don't think it's quite that bleak. We are, I think, in the end, 3 pounds of gelatinous fissured flesh. We're this funny little organs, you know, enclosed within the skull. And yet, in a rather profound sense, we also exceed these materials. You know, we feel like more than just a trillion synapses. And I think that's the essential mystery of the brain. I don't really explore the inherent mystery of self-consciousness in the book. But I think whenever you talk about the brain in strictly materialist terms, I think you have to begin by bracketing that, so to speak, by acknowledging from the start that even though we are on the one hand just 3 pounds, we're, this organ running as much – running on as much electricity as a 20-watt light bulb, we feel like more. I think one of the reasons decision-making appeals to me as a scientific subject is because they're testable questions. You know, it's not like you're trying to explore the mystery of consciousness. You're simply putting people in brain scanners, for the most part, or monitoring individual dopamine neurons in the monkey brain and seeing how they respond to in specific situations, like choosing a breakfast cereal or, playing a stock market game, an experimental economics game in a scanner. So these are testable questions. And so I think that's one of the things that appeals to me about the science, is that they can be rigorous simply because their questions are very specific and targeted.
Are you a science geek? I mean, you've always been this way, seeking for the root causes of things?
I'm very much a science geek. I worked for several years in a great neuroscience lab, the lab of Eric Kandel at Columbia. And I always thought I'd be a scientist, and then I realized I was a terrible scientist. The postdoc I worked for, who's still one of my closest friends, used to joke that I excelled at experimental failure.
Mm-hmm.
And so as much as I wanted to be a scientist, I realized I didn't quite have the disciplined mind to be a scientist, to take these lofty questions and break them down into really testable hypotheses. So that's how I became a science writer, and I think it's one of the great jobs in the world. I get to, talk to a scientist who gets to summarize 10 years of hard manual labor. I get to just translated for everyone else.
Well, I thought that in the scientific world, experiments don't quote-unquote fail. They just they produce data, and they either produce the data you were expecting or they didn't, in which case you rejiggered the experiment. So explain yourself.
That's how it's supposed to work. And unfortunately, experiments often fail, and you don't know if they failed because simply, your PCR didn't work or your Western blot was something wrong with the mechanics of the experiment, in which case the null result is really boring. It's just a, everyday failure, in the same way a souffle sometimes fails. Or you don't know if they failed because your idea is incorrect, mm-hmm. and the hypothesis you're testing is wrong. So it's often very tough to interpret failure. And I think the fact that there's so much failure in science, I think some people estimate that as many as 90% of molecular biology experiments don't work, and no one quite knows why. I think that's very much a stark limitation on you know, it just demonstrates, it reminds us how hard science is, how hard it is to produce these perdurable facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get back to the book.
Yes.
I was thinking as I was reading this book that a lot of medical knowledge has happened because of hideous accidents. The Civil War, where a guy had his stomach blown open, and people were able to observe digestion because there was an open stomach, and we learned a lot about that. Wartime is always a generator.
Absolutely. We learned about phantom limbs from after the Battle of Gettysburg. We learned about Phineas Gage. We learned about a lot of people learn a lot about their brain after Phineas Gage. He's the famous case of the railroad worker who got these spikes
and
obliterated the front of his brain.
Right.
So I mean, we've absolutely. I think it's. In many respects, I think the history of the brain is a history of, A, gruesome accidents, but also disease. I mean, we learned how dopamine works in large part by studying what happens to Parkinsonian patients. Mm-hmm.
It's an exception report, really. Anything that's an exception to the norm tends to be the things you study.
Yeah, exactly. Well, by studying what happens when something's broken, you can learn how something works. So, for example, the case of HM, the famous amnesiac patient who suffered damage in his hippocampus, that's how people like Brenda Milner discovered that the hippocampus was essential for long-term memory. So I think the history of neuroscience is very much the history of studying what happens when things break in the brain.
I'm not going to take you have a lot of examples in the book, and it would be silly just to go over example by example, but I do want you to talk about Elliot and Damasio.
Sure. Antonio Damasio, he was at this point a neurologist, this is the early 80s, he was a neurologist at the University of Iowa, and he began studying patients who, after a brain tumor typically, it obliterated a part of the frontal lobes called the orbital frontal cortex or the ventral medial prefrontal cortex, they lost the ability to experience emotion. So now I think if you go back to people like Plato or Freud, you'd think that these people, they couldn't experience, the everyday pleasures and fear and anxieties the rest of us take for granted. You'd think because they couldn't experience these emotions, they'd become perfect decision makers. They'd become philosopher kings, They wouldn't be led astray by these errant emotional impulses that seem to drive the rest of us to indulge in sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
That's a bad thing?
Well, maybe for a philosopher.
Okay.
But they'd be more rational. They'd be perfectly rational, so they make the best set of decisions possible. Instead, what you find is these people who can't experience emotion become pathologically indecisive, that they'll spend all day choosing where to go eat lunch. They'll spend 5 hours choosing between a blue pen or a black pen or a red pen. So all these everyday decisions we take for granted, these people couldn't make. They just sit there and come up with, a reason they should eat the tuna fish sandwich, but then they come up with reasons they should eat the chicken salad sandwich, and they go back and forth for hours. So it's a very frustrating thing to observe, and yet because they lack these very basic primal emotional cues, they really just couldn't make a decision. They just come up with reason after reason to do one of the alternatives, but then they could come up with reason to do the other alternative too. So this was one of the first pieces of evidence, and became very influential within the scientific field, that maybe our emotions aren't just bad things. Maybe our emotions don't just lead us astray. They don't just gum up the computer inside our head. Maybe they're also an essential part of cognition, period. And that in a sense, I think the real, I think, poignant takeaway of people like Elliot and the work of Damasio is that pure reason, this thing philosophers have been trying to, that we've been aspiring to for so long, pure reason is actually a disease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of that classic Star Trek episode where Captain Kirk gets divided into good Captain Kirk and bad Captain Kirk. And everybody loves good Captain Kirk, but he can't make a command decision.
Huh, that's very interesting. Star Trek,
it's pretty
basic,
but
Star Trek has definitely plumbed these themes, with Spock and Spock being the uber-rational character.
But of course, he has emotions also because he's half-human.
Oh, and so he's not an Elliot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. One of the things that struck me about this, as I read this book, every now and then my eyebrows would go up and I'd say, One of them was about dopamine and gestalt. Dopamine imposes patterns on things when there may not be patterns there.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. And then if you've thought about it at all, tell us about how that relates to the idea of gestalt, where the human mind just seeks to impose patterns on things.
Yeah. Well, dopamine is a very important neurotransmitter, and it's, I think for a long time people thought it was just a hedonic meter, that it simply responded to rewards. Now we know that dopamine is actually a crucial component of learning. It helps us parse reality into chains of causation and correlation, helps us see those patterns. Normally, it's a very good thing. It helps us make sense of the world. Sometimes, though, that can lead us astray. And in the book, I talk about the sad story of Anne Clanestever, who became a slot machine addict. She was diagnosed with Parkinson's. She was put on a dopamine agonist, which is a drug that increases, it mimics the activity of dopamine in the brain. And one of the very common side effects of these drugs is gambling compulsions. Some studies estimate as many as 10% of people develop these gambling compulsions on these dopamine agonists.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
It is. It is. And it was so sad, you know, I think, for the first generation of people, because the doctors didn't know that this was a side effect. And so no one knew, and no one told these patients. And so you have this whole group of subjects who it would never occur to them that in the case of Anne, you know, the idea that this pill, one of the side effects of this pill you're taking for Parkinson's, means that, you know, you become a slot machine addict, and it destroyed her life. Slot machines are the big thing people fall into, and I think that gets back to, you know, in the book I explain why they're so well designed to target and excite the dopamine system. And in the case of Anne, it destroyed her life. She lost all her like savings. Her husband left her. I mean, a very, very sad story. And of course, as soon as she was taken off the medication, the compulsion disappeared within a week. Mm-hmm. So she hasn't gambled in 5 years. But
she shakes again.
Yeah, yeah. But her symptoms have returned. So it's a very, very sad story. And I think the reason what slot machines illustrate is that the dopamine system is great at finding patterns in the real world where there are patterns to find, but it really struggles to deal with random systems where there are no patterns, where it's just, you know, a slot machine is just a random number generator. They're unique in search. You can try to understand the things that predict these random rewards, you know, the output of coins when you get paid back, but there are no patterns to find, and so your brain searches for patterns and becomes transfixed by the randomness, so to speak, and you try to figure out which events predict the payouts, but there's nothing to predict. There are no events to find. And, you know, so in the case of Anne, because she was on these dopamine drugs, the slot machine was simply too alluring. And that's part of what makes, I think, Vegas so surreal, is you have all these people who are riveted by the fact that they're losing money. I mean, you know, over the long term, everyone loses money in Vegas. And yet, because of the way they trigger the system in the brain, we love it. We can't help but just kind of sit there and put quarter after quarter into the machine. And it's not just slot machines. Mm-hmm. The stock market's another example of a random system that people can't help but find patterns in, which is why we, you know, give a percentage of our earnings to hedge fund managers and mutual fund managers, because they promise us they found the secret pattern. But the secret is there is no secret. You know, there's no pattern to find. It's a random walk.
Which leads me to one of the most terrifying terms I read in your book, and that was neuroeconomist. That scared the hell out of me.
Yeah, neuromarketing, I think, is even scarier. Neuroeconomists, that's a fancy term for really just people who have imported some really interesting, I think, experimental protocols from economics. You know, so it's not that they're trying to, you know, take over the world or anything. They're just simply importing some.
And
really,
you know that, do you?
I take them at their word.
Okay.
But there's been a lot of interesting work at this intersection between, I think, economics and neuroscience.
You talk a lot about impulse control and lack of impulse control. Mm-hmm. It occurs to me, I, as I was reading the book, I said to myself, well, gee whiz, what about moral education? Then eventually you do have a chapter or section of the book on moral education. I was thinking about the difference between somebody like me, who is completely undisciplined and I'm not necessarily into instant gratification anymore, but I certainly was for a long time, and people of my parents' generation who were depression babies and learned to delay gratification and sometimes to give it up entirely. They learned to do without, and they learned to be happy without. Did you contemplate that as you were doing the book, and how we differ from our parents in that sense?
That's a fascinating question. I mean, I think one of the interesting things when you talk to scientists about willpower is the realization that willpower is very, very weak. That humans have a spectacular inability to grit their teeth and resist the chocolate cake as long as they're thinking about the chocolate cake. I think, and this gets back to, I think, the weaknesses of the prefrontal cortex, which is the quote-unquote rational brain, which helps you control these bad impulses, the impulses that lead you to sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And you know, one of the experiments I talk about in the book is psychologists at Stanford took two groups of people. One group, they gave a two-digit number to remember to. The other group, they gave a seven-digit number to remember to. Then they had these two groups walk down the hall where they offered them a choice of snacks. One snack was a fruit salad, the responsible choice. The other snack was a slice of chocolate cake. The people who had to remember the 7-digit number were nearly twice as likely to choose the chocolate cake. And why? Well, those 5 extra numbers short-circuited their prefrontal cortex. That's how weak it is. 5 extra numbers can so diminish your self-control because you don't have enough processing power. You're so busy trying to remember these 7 numbers, you don't have enough processing power left over to resist the allure of chocolate cake. So that gets at, I think, just how weak willpower is. And, you know, and so given these innate limitations, these hardwired limitations of the brain, the question becomes, well, then how do we ever resist chocolate cake? How do we, you know, lose weight or quit smoking or not spend money on our credit card? And I think that gets back to stuff that I think is very tough for scientists to study at the moment, which is these kinds of cultural things, these kinds of cultural tropes and ideas we learn as children. And you know, and I think that gets, you know, and these are very complicated questions and very tough to study in a brain scanner, obviously. But I think they're fascinating questions.
I'd like to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Jonah Lehrer. I'm sorry, I called you Lehrer before. Lehrer, like Tom Lehrer. How We Decide is the title of his book, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. Sorry, Jonathan. Yeah, I could be Jonathan now. I just can't decide what your name is. The structures of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, something an occipital, what's the occipital, something?
Orbital frontal cortex.
The insula. Which yes. I found quite interesting.
Yeah, the insula is a funny thing. Well, that's I think now being said because of credit cards.
That's what I'm going to ask you about next. Is loss aversion and the insula?
Yeah,
they go together, right?
It's probably part of the loss aversion network. I think loss aversion is generally associated with something called the amygdala, which is related.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
They both generate negative feelings. You know, those kind of negative emotions, the pain of losing something. So they probably go together. They're part of the same negative, aversive feeling circuit. Loss aversion is a very simple phenomenon. It was first identified by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, a great Israeli psychologist. And what they found was that they came up with a long list of all the ways humans are irrational. And loss aversion is a very simple thing. Let's say we, you know, flip a coin, we'll make a bet. So if the coin, if it's heads, you pay me $1. If it's tails, how much do I have to pay you before you'll accept the bet? Mm-hmm. So if I offer you $1.50, will you accept that bet?
I don't know. Would I?
Most people will start to say yes around $1.75.
Okay.
Or $2. Most people, by the time you get to $2, will start to accept the bet. And what that suggests is that, you know, it's not a rational thing to do at all. If you're an economist or one of those people in an economics textbook, you should accept the bet as soon as it's $1 and a penny. Because then over the long term, you'll make money. But because people are very sensitive to losses, we're rationally sensitive to losses. In fact, I think most economists would estimate that the pain of a loss hurts twice as much as a gain feels good. That makes us loss averse. So we tend to do stuff that keeps us from losing money, like taking those bets. Mm-hmm. You can imagine this may have been helpful millions of years ago back when we were chasing woolly mammoths, but now it often leads us to do very silly things. And the example I give in the book concerns when we evaluate our stock portfolios. And this is, I think, particularly relevant now when people are losing lots of money in the market. And there have been some elegant studies that show that when people evaluate their stock portfolios, because of loss aversion, they tend to sell stocks that have gone up in value. They don't want to make the loss tangible, so they hold on to stocks that have lost money. Right. So that may seem, you know, that may seem like a good idea.
Counterintuitive.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly is. And over the long term, it can lead to, you know, bad things because, of course, over the long term, you're stuck with a portfolio that's composed entirely of stocks that are going down. And so studies have found that the stocks people sell outperform the stocks they hold on to by about 3.5%, which is not insignificant. Mm-hmm. And so that's a clear example of how loss aversion can lead us to do very, very silly things.
Well, the term cut your losses would seem, which this is a term in common parlance and everybody understands what it means, you get rid of the things that aren't performing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what we aspire to. And I think one of the reasons we recite that aphorism to ourselves is to remind ourselves, in a sense, not to be loss averse. And mm-hmm. yet, it's very tough for us not to be loss averse because we got this hardwired flaw in our emotional brain. For whatever reason, losses feel worse and gains feel good. And so we'll do anything we can to make, you know, to avoid making the losses tangible and real.
Tell us about the experiment where you give somebody $10 and he or she has the choice to give somebody else part of that money.
Yeah.
And what happened with that? Because I found this to be in some way hopeful.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a chapter on moral decision making to me was hopeful. I think for a long time we've assumed we're kind of these Hobbesian brutes, you know, these buckets of selfish genes that we're just out for ourselves. We're amoral, nasty creatures. And it turns out when you look at the brain, and I think this is work of the last couple of years, that's not at all what we're like. It turns out we're actually endowed with a very innate set of moral emotions that keep us from hurting each other. And you can see this in a brain scan. You show someone a face of someone who's scared or someone who's in pain, and your own brain lights up as if you were scared or you were in pain. We naturally mirror
empathy.
Yeah, empathy. Exactly. But that's hardwired. We can't help but feel that at a very basic level. And I compare that to the brain of a psychopath, who it seems when you put psychopaths in brain scanners, they lack that basic empathy, that automatic empathy, that automatic sympathy with what someone else is feeling. And that, I think, helps explain why they're more willing and more likely to engage in violence in order to achieve a goal.
They understand that somebody's in pain. They just don't care.
Exactly. Because they lack this very primal moral emotion. Back to the ultimatum game, that's the game with the $10. And when economists began playing this game in the early 80s, they assumed that you give someone $10, and the way the game is, the rules of the game are that one person, the proposer, gets $10. They can propose how to split the money to the responder, person B. If their offer is accepted, so let's say they offer $1 and person B accepts it, then they both get to keep their share. So person A keeps $9, person B keeps $1. So if people were perfectly rational, if we were selfish, rational agents, then you'd expect that to happen every time. So person A is selfish, keeps $9, offers $1 to person B, the minimal amount you can offer. Person B, of course, accepts it because $1 is better than nothing. And if he rejects the offer, then nobody gets anything. So if people were rational, selfish agents, that's what would happen every time. It's not at all what happens. It turns out you can play this game all over the world, and people play the same way everywhere. And what happens is person A offers $5 or $4, but they make generally fair offers, and person B accepts those offers. But we're not as selfish as people assume if we are rational agents. And this gets back to, I think, what's a crucial part of our morality, which is that we're very good at anticipating the feelings of someone else, how someone else will feel if we say something nasty or make an unfair offer or hit them in the face. And it's those moral emotions that allow us to anticipate the thoughts of someone else that keep us from hurting each other. And this makes sense. We're social primates. We have to learn to live in a group. And these moral emotions are a crucial component of what led us to live in a group, so we don't, you know, go around killing each other.
This also might be somewhat tangential to the book, but it's something that occurred to me as I was reading it. We have the brain, which is, you know, the 3.5 pounds of jelly, electrochemical jelly.
Yeah.
And then we have the emanation from that, which is the mind.
Yep.
And Sigmund Freud, who was taken quite a beating in the 20th century and still does, I think was a malign genius because he intuited a lot of the things you're talking about, the brain structures and their functions, the brain chemicals and their functions. When you talk about the id, the ego, and the superego, he is talking about an observational breakdown of brain work that you describe in physical terms in the book.
Yeah, I think one of the crucial insights of Freud, and it's easy to take this for granted now, is his emphasis on the unconscious. He obviously wasn't the first person to talk about the unconscious. I think people like Samuel Taylor Coleridge were talking about it 100 years before Freud. But I think
Freud took drugs.
Yeah. Yes, opium helped Coleridge discover the unconscious. But I think what made Freud such an essential thinker was his emphasis on it, the fact that he said these unconscious motivations are often driving our behavior. And that was a radical idea in the early 20th century. Now I think it's very much, you know, it's very much a cliche of modern neuroscience, the idea that what we're aware of is the tip of the iceberg. And this is why the emotional brain can often be so wise and intuitive, because it's processing far more information than we're aware of. And that's often a very good thing, but sometimes it's a bad thing. Freud tended to focus on the ways it was bad, the way the id could lead us astray.
Well, his patients came in because they had problems.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a great point. But I think his general emphasis on the fact that so many of our motivations are unconscious, are hidden to us, aren't visible to us. You know, this reminds me of that great Nietzsche quote about we're often most ignorant of what is closest to us. And I think that's very much true of the brain, that we're often least aware of what's actually happening inside our head, of why we're actually doing stuff.
We have maybe 2 minutes left, but I really got to ask you this, and I know I didn't give you enough time. I hang out with a bunch of people that love wine and drink a lot of wine, and I am probably the most primitive of all these people. I don't sit there and chew up the wine and say, oh, I taste leather and yeah, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, I either like it or I don't.
Yeah.
And it occurs to me that we have found wines that are as good or better than wines 4, 5, 6 times their cost, and we're not so proud that we won't buy these wines because we just want to have a good wine to drink.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we have been willing to pay $60 for a bottle of wine from time to time. Tell us about these blind taste tests that they did, and if you can do it in about a minute and a half, that'd be great.
Sure. It turns out that people are very bad at actually that there's almost no correlation between the price of a wine and the quality of a wine or the amount of pleasure people get from a wine. So I talk in the book about some brain scanning experiments where people sipped wine via plastic tubes in fMRI machines, and the scientists...
Worst way to drink wine.
Yeah. I imagine that's not the most pleasurable way, being inside a noisy coffin, in essence, sipping wine. And so these scientists played a trick on the subjects. They gave them three different California Cabernets, a $5 one, a $15 one, and a $45 one. But they told them, they actually gave them five different samples. And what they found was that if you told someone they were drinking $90 wine, they always preferred the $90 wine, no matter what. So they always liked the most expensive wines. And sure enough, you could see in the brain, the $90 wine turned on a pleasure part of the brain, so to speak. So expensive wine tastes better because we think it's expensive, and so it should taste better. So our preconceived notions make the wine more enjoyable. However, when you play a trick on people and you give them all the wines blind, and you don't tell them how much they cost, it turned out, and you can do this with wine experts too, guess which wine they enjoyed the most? The $5 one. The cheap plonk. That was their favorite wine.
Mm-hmm.
And this built on a large body of research. I talked in my first book about work done by Frederick Brochet, who, you know, he played all sorts of tricks.
Mention the title of your first book because it's great.
Proust was a neuroscientist.
Okay.
He played all sorts of tricks on wine experts and showed that you can get, if you dye a white wine red and you give it to a wine expert and you say, oh, describe the bouquet. They'll say, oh, this is full of crushed red fruit and rich tannins. You know, these standard adjectives we use to describe red wine.
A load of crap in effect.
A load of crap is the polite way of putting it.
Yes.
So, and these are experts, and yet, you know, it really speaks to how powerful a role our expectations play in governing our perceptions.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, to paraphrase Paul Simon, a man tastes what he wants to taste and disregards the rest.
After reading this book, I sometimes get the feeling that we're just pathetic meat puppets and we're driven by things we can barely understand.
I think that's about right.
Okay. It's been great talking to you. Jonah Lehrer. Lehrer. The title of the book is How We Decide Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Please come back again.
Thank you so much.